This is the Amp Hour Podcast, released March 25th, 2024. Episode 663. Motors on PCBs with Carl Bugea. Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Chris Gamel of Contextual Electronics.
Hi, I'm Carl Bugea. I'm an engineer from Molo.
Hey, Carl, how are you?
Hi, Chris.
It's good to chat with you. I have to imagine, as you're sitting in your lab right now, like when I imagine you in your lab, it's just like flexure circuits just like going in the background, like like almost like cuckoo clocks and like, you know, just kind of like they're just everything's flapping and electronically actuated. Is that correct or not?
Sometimes it is, yeah.
Yeah, okay, all right.
The sounds really get to my head, so.
Yeah. They're flapping. Yeah, I guess we would probably hear it. Those are not quiet machines that you build.
Not all of them. Some are quiet. It depends on the speed that you run them with. But they can be quiet. But to test their durability, you have to test them at like 20 hertz. So if it's hitting something, it can get a little bit noisy.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so it's already in the audible range. And you start getting up into the 60 hertz and above and you start to hear it pretty easily, huh? Have you created like, you know, like how they do the hard drive musical things? Have you tried that where you have like multiple flappy things going at different frequencies to try and like make a little orchestra?
Yeah, that's a little, I haven't done that yet, but I
coming soon from Carl. Yeah.
That would be interesting to test out.
Yeah. Well, that's great. So people should, I guess we should state up front. You have a wonderful YouTube channel, one of my favorite YouTube channels, where you do experiments or like flex circuits and electronics and things like that. And I reached out to you because you started selling some of your creations recently as well. And I wanted to talk about that and just your history and kind of everything you've built. How did you get started in this space?
So to start from the beginning, I graduated from university as an electronics engineer. So it's kind of my line of work. And all my life, I basically like to tinker with wood, with electronics and building stuff. So it's kind of my hobby and building robots. So that's kind of it's sort of my work, but it's also my passion. And on my YouTube channel, I started experimenting with PCB motors and PCB actuators. And almost, I think now it's been 5 years doing this thing. And it's finally progressed into something that can actually be turned into kits or products. And it's been a little bit busy.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. And I mean, that is a big switchover too, where it's like moving from experiments to productization. It's like, and I think this, one thing I thought about immediately is just like the, you know, you document a lot of your trials and tribulations and failures. And I love that you do that, but I'm not sure that someone purchasing a kit is going to be as forgiving. They'd be like, I bought this thing from Carl and it doesn't work. And it's like, well, yeah, you know, you got to try it out. You got to try different things, you know?
Yeah, we do a lot of testing before, because it's from a prototype to a product, there's a huge difference. You need so for example, for my flappers, I had to make sure that they don't break after some time and do all this testing related to that. I mean, it's easy just to make a YouTube video and show, look, this thing work. And then it's a whole different spectrum than selling something, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and so what is the new company called? Where you're selling the stuff?
Our website was, I'm doing it with my cousin. It's called microbots.io. And the aim is, so we're sort of phase one where we're like releasing actuators and hopefully soon there will also be PCB motors. So the first step is like getting the actuators and motors to work reliably and good. And hopefully the stage two is integrating them into robots and displays. So we're also working on some cool interactive displays. I mean, some actuators are already like the flapper. I mean, it's already like been through all our testing, and I mean, so far I have no other ideas on how to improve it further. So the next stage for that is integrating it into products, which we have multiple projects related to that ongoing.
That's great. Yeah, no, I mean, people can go to microbus.io right now and see kind of the, I really like that you actually have the coming soon too, where you're teasing the new stuff, because then it allows people to kind of see what, it's almost like a quasi roadmap, but then also like maybe pre-order and talk to you about it if they have other ideas, or hopefully give you money to help fund, you know, hardware's not cheap. So.
Yeah, hardware's not cheap, no, but the main goal for the coming soon is just to show a little bit of what we're working on, and if someone is interested, just he can just put his email address, and once we launch that product, he will get notified. So,
yeah. How much do you have to deal with the public misunderstanding of like power delivery in like these motor type situations? Like, do people like call you up and say like, oh, awesome, I'm going to like lift my car up with a, you know, a PCB actuated flap?
So every time I release a video, I receive a bunch of DC emails.
Not really?
Yeah. It's either that or either companies just want to collaborate or stuff.
Of course,
like that.
Yeah.
But I mean, our goal is just to work on tiny motors and actuators. And yeah. I mean, there are other companies that, for example, are working on PCB motors and integrating them into cars and stuff like that. But my goal, for example, with the PCB motor was always to make like an easier to build and a cheaper alternative than the other motor, than what's available commercially that has the copper, the coil windings and stuff like that. It's easy to drift from the original goal, because I can go and make a bigger motor and have it be 5x more efficient, but our goal was always, I mean, ever since I started my YouTube channel, was always to create a tiny motor that can be used. That, I mean, it's not an efficient motor, but it's efficient enough to be used in robotics.
Right. It won't burn itself up is probably the most important thing in the beginning, right?
Yeah.
I feel like one of the problems too is just like popular culture. Like when I see your stuff and just like these kind of like seemingly self-driven, obviously there's intelligence behind them. There's, you know, you're driving them yourself, whatever. But just this kind of like this realm of things, my mind jumps to like Big Hero 6. Did you ever watch that movie from Pixar with like the actually Microbot? Microbots? What are they called? They called them something that.
They called Microbots. I mean,
they were called Microbots. Yeah.
I think one of the inspirations behind the name. We considered like a couple of names, but I think because when it comes to PCB actuators, I mean, let's put it this way. If you have just one actuator, you need to have one PCB components for one, but imagine having that same PCB multiplied by 10x.
Yeah, right.
So
right.
It's going to be the same, the PCB is going to have the same price, you're just going to pay extra for the components. So that is one of our main things that we're working on. So
efficiency of the solution, because PCB materials is effectively commodity at this point, you can kind of start to expand using that.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, this is still an ongoing thing that we're currently working on and nothing is published yet, but having one actuator or one motor is cool, but what other applications could be created if you have like 10 motors on one PCB?
So that's some
of the things that we're currently playing with.
Yeah, totally. I just feel like Big Hero 6 ruined my brain because I'm like, oh yeah, tiny little microbots that are like, you know, self-powered and, you know, can self-assemble. It's just like,
yeah, I mean, that, no. that would be pretty cool. But so far, I think we have to focus on just one dimension.
Yeah. Yeah. They might have taken a couple mental leaps in a animated film, yeah. I got to say. Yeah. Well, you're fighting a good fight. That's what's important. Let's talk about some of the realities of putting current through a PCB like this. Like, okay, so let's maybe paint a picture for people with words. You know, we only have words here, but we're painting a picture. Someone's going to, like, what is your kind of common use case when you're thinking about, maybe we just talk about like the flat flap. Oh, that's a tough one to say. The flat flap is like so it's like a flex PCB on top of a rigid PCB. Is that what that is?
Yeah, so it's basically one flexible PCB that have aluminum stiffeners.
Okay.
It has two aluminum three, which then folds the PCB together, has a pocket for a magnet, and the coil interacts with the magnet.
Got it. Okay. And then there's a solid state magnet on there or no, or is it only?
Yeah, it's a normal, I mean, an N52 magnet. Uh-huh. So it's the highest grade of magnet. So when the coil is energized, it's basically create a small magnetic field that is like strong enough to move the coil upwards.
Got it. Okay. All right. And yeah, and so I'll link to the, you know, I'm gonna have show notes here. I'll link to the actual product itself. But this is the one, if people have seen your latest video, where it's moving like a butterfly wing, like a printed butterfly wing. That's a great example there. So it's moving paper in that case, and you're showing it like moving a ping pong ball as well, and some mirrors, that sort of thing.
Yes, so far that it's one of the most popular applications for it is I think it's mostly used by artists, so to create kinetic sculptures and stuff like that.
Got it. Okay. So then now we're talking about this sort of thing, and what is the actual, like, what is the current that's going through a coil to actually like make motion happen?
So the current that it obviously depends on the voltage you run it at, but it's usually around 180 milliamps.
Okay.
So that is the constant, if you drive it at constant power, because you can like generate small pulses to not overheat it and stuff like that.
Yeah. So that's another good point then too. So like, what does it take? Like how, do you have monitoring on board or do you just kind of have like a general knowledge of like, don't overdrive it past this point? Like how much do you have to like, if someone was implementing this specific thing, how much did they have to do it? How much do they have to like kind of tweak controls to make sure they don't burn it up or overdrive it or anything like that? Yeah. And then how much then would they have to do if they weren't using a product like yours?
Yeah, so I mean, there's obviously the main limitation is the temperature rating of the PCB, which is, I think it's 130 degrees Celsius.
Okay.
But on our website, we listed it as 5 volts maximum.
Okay.
And that rating is derived from the resistance of the coil, because the coil itself has a DC resistance that is dependent on the length of the coil. So depending on how many turns the coil has, it will increase the length, and it will add a series resistance apart from inductance.
Mm. Okay, so then it's just a geometry problem at that point, like geometry times copper thickness kind of thing, huh?
Yeah, because it just depends on the number of turns, and you can easily derive also the length and try to estimate it from a couple of PCB calculators. But I mean, there are other problems, like because there's like the variation of the trick width that the PCB manufacturer has, so we had to deal with that, for example, and other things. But that's mostly where the power rating comes from.
Okay. And you said 130 for the PCB temp. What is that, just the delamination? How do you determine that as like a max temp?
So there's the TG value. So for normal PCBs, it can go up for example to 170 degrees Celsius. And I think it's common practice to like go to like 30 to 40 degrees lower than that when operating PCBs at high temperature.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah, that's great. I've never push the bounds with my stuff like that. You know, like I always just try and like give myself tons of operating margin. And it's like, by definition, you're trying to do it at the limits because it's like that you get more out of it in this way, right?
Yeah. I think this is a very interesting field. I learned a lot from it when trying to build PCB heaters. So
The self-soldering circuit. I saw that one.
Yeah. The self-soldering was like the last step. But before that, I tried to build like a PCB reflowing hot plate, which didn't work. I mean, it worked. There's a lot of people trying them right now. But the main conclusion was that it wouldn't be reusable. So after like five times, you could see like the solder mask, the color and stuff like that. This is obviously when the PCB reaches around 200 degrees Celsius, for example, just enough for the solder to reflow.
Mm. Just need to start with like brown solder mask and then you're set, right?
Yeah,
but I don't see any discoloration. What's the problem here, folks?
Yeah, but I mean, after that, I think it sort of proven the self-reflowing PCB idea was sort of perfect because the PCB just had to reflow one time. It had to reach like 170 degrees Celsius for just one time, and then it's done because it's a function of time as well. Like there's how much PCB can sustain heat, it's a function of time. Yeah. And 6 minutes, it's like still okay for it.
Got it. And then you also made one about flex PCBs too, because obviously you're doing this on rigid FR4, but then also flex. So then like, how do you think about, you know, choosing project types between those two?
Yeah, it really depends on the nature of the project. If there's, for example, something like mechanically where the flexible PCB can, for example, avoid wires or be like a little bit simpler. I mean, that's why I like to use flexible PCBs because it usually offers this kind of opportunity. Where you like, instead of using wires, I know, I mean, it's just wires, but when you like consider producing hundreds of this thing, soldering wires one by one, it's going to be a little bit of annoying.
I feel like that same like truism that like could be applied to anything. It's just wires. It's just resistors. It's just transistors. It's just billions of transistors. You know what I mean? Like it's just like it's just turtles all the way down.
Yeah, and I think it also looks neater.
Yeah, totally. I always think about you know, batch processing generally, right? Like whenever this always comes up when people are talking about like, well, I want to make like a PCB robot, something that like draws traces on a PCB. And even if it was like perfect copper drawn onto a PCB, like perfectly conductive copper drawn onto a surface, right? That's like always what these PCB printers look like. It's like you're still rastering versus like batch processing. Just the fact that you're doing batch etching on something like a flex PCB or a regular PCB, like that's one of the big advantages from my perspective of just like, just the chemical element of it all. Mm-hmm. When you have to do any kind of like point to point or whatever, you know, however you define that, you know, raster kind of process, you almost immediately lose out to a batch processing.
Exactly.
Stamping versus milling, you know, there's always these sort of things. So it's just then you really take advantage of a lot of the capabilities with flex. So that's great. Okay. So now you're designing FR4 or flex coils. How much math are you doing on a daily basis? Do you math? I don't math anymore, Carl. I know you're a little closer to university days, but I am very far from my university days. And I don't.
Yeah, really do me math. Too. I mean, it's all. I mean, I think no. It. I'm close at being 10 years.
10 years. Oh wow. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yep. Because I graduated in 2016. So.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, you're getting there, huh? Yep. So how much do you do? So is it, how much is it like experimental versus like? When's the last time you touched Maxwell's equations? How about that?
Yeah. No, basically, I started as like doing, like it was like iterative. That's how it started. Then as I started getting more in depth, I started trying to like estimate the perfect length to get the temperature right. Uh-huh. Because, for example, one of the things that a few people notice flexible PCBs, for example, will get hotter than FR4 PCBs because they have much less area because they are super thin. So the heat that the coil generates will transfer easily.
Yeah, like the heat capacity of the material and stuff like that.
Exactly. As well. So there was like stuff like this, like for example, the tolerance of the manufacturer. That was one of the things that I didn't even consider in the beginning. Then when I started receiving batches of the same coil, different manufacturing batches of the same coil with different resistance. Obviously,
interesting.
There's an extra problem that you have to solve.
Yeah. And how did you get into that? Did you start doing like incoming inspection and stuff like that?
Yeah. So what I started noticing is that if you order at different batches, I mean, the manufacturer will either use a different factory or a different machine or stuff like that. So there will be a tolerance in the copper thickness, there are some tolerances. So, but the main problem I think was the width. So I was fortunate to get to the root of this. My local university offered me to inspect it with the X-ray machine.
Oh, that's nice.
So I could like measure the sort of not accurately measure, but it was visible that there was a problem with the clearance between the copper traces, copper windings.
Oh, really? Yeah. So this was the trace to trace spacing because of like the etch process versus
So it's like the pitch between the tracks.
Okay. All right. What was the net result of that? Was that overheating?
Yeah. I mean, there's not much you can do about it, but you have to like tell to the manufacturer to measure the resistance and make sure that the same process or the same machine is used for the same orders and stuff like that.
Got it. So when you send out a design, right? So you have sponsors in your videos, which is great. And a lot of those are lower cost PCB services, which many of which I use and love. Are you sending really well specified like PCB drawings then as well?
Yeah, I usually write the specifications on the PCB design file itself to make sure that whoever is seeing the files before they get manufactured is well aware of what's being there.
Yeah. Got it. I just feel like when I, when I was starting to use some of the lower cost PCB services, as they were coming up, because I think they rose after I was making PCBs, I was just like, oh, they got this, no problem. But then it was like, a couple of times I'm like, oh, yeah, right, controlled impedance traces or like thicknesses, where it really, at the end of the day, it's, on us as like manufacturing engineers, effectively, like switching our hats from design engineering to manufacturing engineering. It's like that incoming inspection and like giving feedback about process type stuff like you're dealing with. It's just, it becomes a whole other job,
Yeah, I mean, it was the same for me because using like these types of manufacturers, some of them are good and some of them are bad.
Right.
Exactly. So that's why I picked one and stayed with them for a long time.
I'm not picking on the low cost services. I think it's really that because there's no way around it with like the traditional PCBs manufacturers, like they won't accept the files without a drawing with it, right? Whereas like, low cost manufacturers are just like, you're using our process, no big deal. It's like, for me, I'm like, oh yeah, you still need to send the file with it, right? Even if you're, no matter who you're using, that's the big catch that I'm getting at.
Yeah. And I think they're improved quite a lot because now there's some advanced options and stuff like that. So I don't usually get a lot of problems from their side now that everything is sorted out. So
That's great. So now you are moving into the manufacturing stage with microbots and stuff like that. Yeah. Do you now have more like test tooling in-house? Do you have to do that?
Yeah, we do some testing, but the testing we're doing so far is making sure that the supplier sent us, like we're checking the supplier sort of. So the PCB supplier.
Okay, yeah, doing what they're saying they're doing, that sort of thing.
Because obviously they do their testing as well, and we like to have to make sure that the quality of the PCBs that they have sent us is to what we specified.
Yeah, and I mean, I think you have an interesting new sector, not sector, new characteristic that I've never actually had a test for before, which is like motion, right? Like I've never had a final test stage where I'm like, is this thing moving properly or not? But I would imagine you have to do that sort of thing. Are you, do you do that with like vision or just like?
Yeah. So for example, with the flaps, it has to do with the with the coil's resistance. For example, if it's like we check if it's in within its specified range, and if it's between that range, we know for sure that its motion will be correct. So we're using the coil's DC resistance to check for its motion as well. And obviously, we do also visual inspection and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
to make sure that, for example, the flexible PCB is not bended, like folded, for example, in the wrong manner or stuff like that.
Right. Yeah, I imagine like you have like the time flap, which is like a new kind of persistence of vision thing, and then like a robot as well that are coming, and those kind of have all alternate like. Again, like I've just never dealt anything with motion before as like a final test stage. That's an interesting thing.
Yeah, so the time flap is the longest ongoing project that we have, because I think it's been going on since I released the first prototype, and we're almost there. But the scary thing about it is producing, like when you start thinking about producing hundreds of it, because mechanically it will affect the behavior of the screen. So we like introduce stuff into it, like automatic tuning of the frequency and stuff like that to make sure that the flap continues flapping at the right speed. It got a little bit complicated, but it's one of the fun projects we've been working on.
The flap factor or the flappiness, is that a you need to make up your own terms to start branding around these sort of things.
And we also think, because after the engineering is finished, there's like the thing, does it look nice in everyone's eye or not? Then there's those other aspects as well. So
that's true. Yeah, I guess when you have like these visual elements, like it's aesthetics. You know, people always have, I guess, opinions are like belly buttons. Everybody has one. That's not the not the original phrase, but modified for family friendliness. So you just have to kind of do almost like user testing and just be like, is this like okay enough to everyone?
I think that's really important as well, because I mean, before you go with the, it's not a risk, but it's a huge like headache, to release a product. So you have to make sure that everything is on point.
Yeah. Well, and even like, you know, you do a lot of videos, and like you do your best to be able to show it on video, which is not easy when it's a moving LED thing on its own, you know, just like frame rates and stuff like that. But then just matching people's expectations from seeing it on video versus seeing it in person, that's always tough too.
Exactly.
Yeah. What about, so you also have like, you use a lot of drivers for these sort of things. I've used like some Allegro parts in the past, like drive circuits. What makes for a good drive circuit for motors or PCBs or things like it?
Yeah. So I've tested a lot of different drivers, but one of the main things that it's my number one priority is if the driver is small. So for example, in my last PCB motor video, I created like a custom fully driver, but the PCB was quite large compared to the motor. So for me, that doesn't make sense. So having like a one chip that could replace that all is like a bonus.
Yeah.
So I think size is since we're like creating tiny robotics and having like flat actuators and stuff like that, I think size is the number one priority when it comes to drivers.
I always think to myself, I'm like, well, it's like mostly an H bridge. I could like do it myself. Right? It's like I could buy transistors and build it myself. It's like, That is generally the wrong idea, I feel like. Like, you could, but should you, right? It's like kind of the other stuff that's in there.
Yeah, I think all engineers go with this approach.
Yeah, yeah. Until they get some shoot through and blow up a board, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, like, how advanced are these chips at this point? Like, are there additional features that are in these driver chips that you look for, or is it just kind of is it, like you said, just size and just general efficiency?
So for the PCB motor, there's quite a number of chips that were available. I tested a bunch and just selected the one that performed the best. But I mean, for the driver of the actuator, it's just an age bridge, literally. And then we created a library so that people can just use it to control our actuators.
Okay, great. Yeah, so the library has like an interface in front of it, or no, like a microcontroller in front of it, or is it just driving that specific?
It's just drive a specific waveform. We created multiple examples, so one of them can just be used with any Arduino, and then there's one that is more specific for the ESP family, because one of our next modules is going to have an ESP32C3. So it integrates with that nicely. Regarding drivers, there's a ton of options. For example, age bridges, there's a ton of options. And like, if you like see these little Chinese chips that are sort of like knockoffs, they can be really cheap as well. But I think you also have to select a safe option as well. So yeah, something right. So that's one of the things that we tested. For example, like, there was a chip, a specific Chinese power chip, that was like 5 times cheaper, but I mean, the data sheet was in Chinese.
Right.
RDS on was not specified in the data sheet, so there's stuff like this.
Really? That, okay.
Yeah.
So, like, yeah, so, you get what you get, you know. Like.
Yeah.
We recommend underdriving this chip.
I think sometimes you also have to favor the quality rather than having everything cheap.
Yeah. Yeah. And it seems like you said, with like building a library too, like having the knowledge of a particular family and just the knowing the corners of operation and where things could go wrong, and maybe having that in your library so you are dealing with a very particular chip. It's not like just a generic, it's not like an overall generic thing. It's more like specific to different drivers, right?
Yeah.
What about, so you have a project on your YouTube that's pretty great, the little four-wheeled foldable robot. So like that as a project, which I think you might be selling in the future, is that right?
We're not 100% sure about it, because I mean, first we're currently in the final stages of like finalizing the motor. So once that is finalized, we will take it like to the next step, which would be two-wheeled robots, hopefully.
Got it.
And then we'll see. We also test it out with the rover. But the thing is that our goal is to create small robots that could interact with each other someday. And like, to do that, you have to bring the price of the robot to a very low price. So having two wheels rather than four would be cheaper.
Right. Two fewer wheels is, you know, savings.
So that's one of the things that we're still exploring.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, I'm amazed at some of the, you know, some of the manufacturers that can do like those little RF drone, you know, they give you like for like $20, they will send you like a little quadcopter with a remote, and they like talk to each other. You know, they've got RF link, and it's just like unbelievable that all that stuff can happen. Obviously it's a toy, but like that you can get that all working and it actually flies, you know, for $20. And that means they're making it for what, like $4 maybe, you know, like
it's crazy.
Yeah. So in the case of that sort of thing, like, so you have a controller on board there, and that is then driving a couple of motor drivers that then actually drive the the coils that are on board, that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, so the rover was made from one flexible PCB that folded together to form like a cube shape and a cuboid shape, sorry. And then the wheels get bolted onto the sides of the cuboid and it just drives. So it has PCB motors. So the stators are integrated into the PCB and the magnets of the motor are integrated into the wheels themselves. I mean, it was a very fun project, especially to design. The final result, I think, was not that great, but I think it can be improved in several ways.
Yeah, I mean, and yeah, well, you said, I mean, it looks like that's a ESP32 on there, but you said you're switching to the C3 for certain
products. Yeah, we're switching to the C3. I mean, it's one of the most popular microcontrollers that has Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, I think, the C3.
S5, that's cool.
Yeah.
It's cool. I mean, it really doesn't matter at all from like, you know, like other than like me saying S5 is like, oh, okay, but it still interact with it through code. So, and it works. So it's cheaper.
Yeah, and its package is yeah, really small as well.
Yeah.
So for us, it hit all the right boxes. So it has a like an okay price. It was, it has one of the smallest packages available. And it's getting quite popular with Arduino users. So that's why we went for it. So because we would like to make it like into a maker kit. So we want to make it as easy as possible for people to use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. Are you developing, when you're developing stuff for Arduino in that case, are you writing a new library or are you kind of piggybacking off existing libraries?
Yeah, it's kind of the two cases at the moment. So we're using some libraries and we're also creating our own things as well.
Okay. You doing any ESP IDF or anything like that?
No, not yet.
No. Okay. Yeah, I've dug into a little bit. I'm generally very impressed with how advanced the RTOS is, this, you know, just how it's progressed over time. And that's what I think is running under the hood for all the Arduino port as well, is it's running ESP IDF under the hood.
Okay.
But it's, you know, it's more advanced and I'm still struggling a little bit with it, you know. Yeah. But yeah, that's nice. And then, so then can you, with the Arduino libraries that you use for it, are you able to have then remote control? Like, what is the remote control look like? Are you actually, you're actually using the Bluetooth and Wi-Fi in order to control this thing?
Yeah, so for the rover, I connected it to a PlayStation joystick and it just connected through Wi-Fi. But in the future, I think we're also experimenting with the idea of connecting ESPs together and using one as the controller and one as the robot.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Cool things like that.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I mean, you could, the ESP Link is, I think they have like their own protocol as well.
Yeah, I think so.
That sort of thing. That's pretty fun. Any plans to internet connect it? Are you gonna make it so that you could rover around the the internet?
Yeah, I think
it's like connected stuff to the internet, right?
All the things that's happening with ESP right now, there's ESP Home, and I think all of that stuff is quite interesting to look at. So
yeah, we had Keith on the show from Nabucasa talking.
Yeah,
about
I heard the episode yesterday.
Yeah, so maybe we'll put you two together and see what, you know, little home rovers. That would that's the jam right there. Carl, how long until I get a little very, very tiny robot rover to fetch me a beer? That's what we really need. Yeah. That's like the classic robot thing, right? It's like getting a soda or a beer out of the fridge.
Yeah, maybe Spot will do that for you someday.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's their goal right now, to like go into the domestic things.
Oh, the Boston Dynamics and like their little electric dog. Yeah. As much as I have a friend that works there and I love him to death, but everything they do is creepy. I'm so creeped out. Every time it's always the uncanny valley with those, because it's just, they're moving into that space. It's just like,
I think it's quite cool. The first thing that I've done after I graduated, I sent my CV to them. Uh-huh. I said, like, this is my only chance if it's either this or start like my own thing. they never got back to me.
And so I just said, yeah, I guess, you know what? We need you to go make robots on YouTube for everybody to check out. So that's good. I mean, that's the thing though, too. Like I love that you're doing this kind of stuff on YouTube because it's just going to, I have to imagine people contact you who are up and coming through the space and they're just like, yeah, I want to build more stuff like you're building.
Yeah, I think that that's one of the main rewards from making YouTube videos. You inspire others, especially mm-hmm. young makers and young students. Mm-hmm. I mean, receiving those kind of emails is quite rewarding.
Yeah. That's great. Do you end up, so do you have did you build a community with this sort of thing as well then? Like where do people gather to gather and agog over your creations and or build their own?
I think it's mostly through social media. So people who follow either my Instagram or my Twitter, not that much lately, but more Instagram.
Well, I'm sure there's, you know, you're making robots and I'm sure the bots love following you on Twitter.
One of us. But I mean, it's mostly through Instagram and email.
Okay, cool. That's great.
It's nice to see that.
Have you seen like kind of follow along projects that are like, oh, I saw Carl doing this and now I'm building my own. Do you get to see those as well?
Yeah, I do see some of them sometimes. Some of my builds are a little bit of expensive. That's one of the main reasons why we started Microbots, to make them more accessible. So it's a little bit like, I mean, if I was a student back in my student years, I couldn't afford a flexible PCB or now they're much cheaper than what they were before, but
it's almost like standardized components at this point might as well get a jump start by using your stuff. And then if they need to, like,
exactly,
I don't know, I started building a robot at one point and like I'm like, I need to build everything from the ground up and build every like driver, and it's like, well, I could have gone to, was it Pinoco? There are a bunch of like DF Robot and like there's all these other sites too that like had these components, and I should have started there and gotten the end robot working instead of starting at the bottom up, right? It's like you're at the point where you are optimizing for a very specific application, which makes a lot of sense to me. Yeah. But like as a beginner as I was, I shouldn't have started at the beginning there, or I shouldn't start at the bottom.
Yeah, I think that makes sense because I mean, when I was a student, I was doing the same exact thing. Yeah. So that's the main reason why these type of kits make sense.
Yeah.
For us to build, because and sell, just for others to either test out and perhaps inspire them to create something better, and hopefully they will.
Yeah, that's great. So after uni, you went out into the world as well. Like, what did you end up, what were you doing when you had gone out before you started, I guess, in conjunction with you going out into the world or going into the world of YouTube? What were you designing when you were in the commercial space?
Yeah, so it's a bit of a, I mean, not a long story, but after I ended university, I sent the CV to Boston Dynamics and I didn't get a reply from them. And so I started a startup with my friend. We were working on drones and Bluetooth tags. At the time, the drones were still like getting popular, so it made sense to go into that space. But I mean, after a few months, like we couldn't fund it more, because we are still like in the R&D stage, and it was going to take months or even years for us to turn it from a prototype to a product, because it wasn't just a quadcopter, it was a coaxial type of drone. So propeller drone, like the size of a tennis ball.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah, that's tough. That's a lot of control there, huh? Yeah. Like a lot of feedback and stuff like that.
Exactly. The main problem was manufacturing, I think, because it had like flaps and stuff like that. And when you compare it to a quadcopter, it's much easier to produce a quadcopter rather than a coaxial drone.
Yeah, a lot of margin in the quad.
Yeah, and a lot of plastic things and stuff like that.
Yeah.
At the time, we had a cheap 3D printer, and 3D printers were still starting as well.
Yeah.
Then after the startup failed, I went into the automotive industry. So I worked there for 3.5 years, during which time I was also doing YouTube videos as well. So during this time, I was working on designing electronics for concept vehicles. So I did this for 6 months, but then I was switched to software. So I was doing mainly software that goes into devices that connects with the CAN network of a car and stuff like that.
Yeah, okay. Cool.
I mean, and I learned a lot from that experience because the products that they were making, they were producing thousands of them. So I learned a lot from just the difference of producing one thing and producing 100,000 of that thing.
Yeah.
That was quite a learning experience.
And that was in Malta where you're based. Is automotive big there? What are the industries?
Not that there's only one company.
There's the company.
Yeah. Not one company, it's just one company that designs electronics for automotive. Uh-huh.
Got it. Okay.
So it's called Metode Electronics. And cool. I was quite happy for some time then. But then, COVID hit and things were a little bit different, and I decided to try and switch full time on YouTube, and not just YouTube, just doing what I love doing, just building electronics in my garage.
That's great.
And that worked pretty well, I think.
Yeah. We were talking a little bit about just what I was asking what Malta's like in terms of the electronics industry and stuff like that before the show as well. And it sounds like there's not a lot there, but there is stuff you've got some folks in the town and stuff like that. And
yeah, so it's a pretty small island here. So you cross from one end to the other in an hour. So.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah. It's quite small.
Important thing is do the PC, how's DHL service and how fast can you get a DigiKey box? That's my judgment.
That's okay.
Yeah. And I guess how is import duties too? That's another thing that I don't really think about here, but it is, even here I have to pay them. They're just usually attached.
I mean, the only postal service that sucks is UPS here. So, but I mean, for me, it's quite, because I have all my family here, so it's quite nice having to live here.
Yeah.
And I don't see a reason so far to move to anywhere else.
No, I think that is really great. I mean, the fact that it's gotten so much easier to be able to be a manufacturer on your own, or just send off design files to have stuff just kind of remote assembled. Just thinking about 20, 30 years ago, the services were there, but maybe the communication wasn't. And, I think even just the industry of being able to, I think even things like Shopify and similar marketplaces for selling gear, it's just so much easier than it used to be. There's logistics and online stuff. All that stuff has really improve the ability to then manufacture somewhere locally in China, somewhere else, have a store of equipment, have a store of merchandise rather, and then being able to sell it. You could potentially never touch the hardware if you wanted to and still have an electronics business,
I think the world we live in makes everything simpler to do something like this. It's not something that you would be able to do, I think, in the early days.
Yeah, it's definitely gotten a little better in that way, so that's really nice. What's on your as much as you're willing to share. What's on your like your project list other than the stuff, you know, obviously people can go on microbots.io and see kind of the coming soon or the test stuff. But like, what's the thing that you think about like, oh, I want to learn that or I want to build that. Like what's on your list of things to do with PCB actuators and motors and things like that? Where's the future of this space?
I think the future is like find a simple way to control multiple PCB actuators. Actuators on the same PCB. This is something I've been trying to do for, I think, the last 1.5 years. So I've been researching a lot of different options out there. And I've always come to the same conclusion. And I think we're finally a step closer at doing that finally. And that's why we named it Microbots and all that stuff. Because it's the main goal.
And does that mean like, so is each coil going to have its own microcontroller? Like, I guess that's one thing you could do with low cost microcontrollers as well, but then programming becomes an issue. Like what is enabling that sort of thing to happen?
Yeah, I think it's like, I don't want to spoil too much, but
okay.
the way we're thinking about it is like daisy chaining the coils. So
got it. Okay. Yeah, I mean, even if you had like, so you have your plug and play controller, right? The Flexar, and that looks like that's, you know, a way to interface to these different things and like kind of abstract some of the difficulties. But then, do you have one per board, and you kind of pass the idea down the line?
That's exactly. It stops making sense, sort of.
Yeah. I mean, like I've been playing with like low cost, like the CH32 V003s and stuff like that. And those are low cost, and maybe you could put a bunch of those on a board, but it doesn't mean it's easy to do, nor would it be fast to program that, right? It's still like it's almost just a scaling problem, right?
Yeah. Because I mean, there's a lot of different options, and the problem is not just scaling. The problem is like the price per cell, sort of. So the price per one coil.
Yeah.
Because it would be, I mean, you can do it with like, just an H bridge, but you would have a lot of wires. But then once you solve the wires problem, like how expensive is it to drive one coil? And if you find a driver that can drive multiple coils at once, is it like cheap enough to make sense or not? So that's one of the main problems we've been trying to solve.
Oh, interesting. And do you think it'd be possible to drive multiple? Maybe this is the thing you didn't want to talk about, but is it possible to drive more than one coil with a single driver to like start to, again, just drop the price per cell?
Yeah, it is possible, but I mean, that's not the way we decided to go, because it, compared to the solution we're working on right now, it ended up being more expensive, because the type of drivers that can drive like 6 or 12 coils still cost like €8 when you buy them in hundreds or thousands. So yeah, it's their price like don't drop
right,
even though they're just one IC. So
yeah, it's kind of interesting. It's almost like, you know, like, so obviously as LEDs were coming up, right, they started to think like, oh well, we could like use them as backlights for TVs, and then over time, like the reason TV, like flat panel TVs are so cheap these days, because they're effectively not printing, but they're, you know, like the array of an LED TV is kind of the same problem, where they're dropping the price per pixel, right? Or, you know, whatever. Does a motor have a pixel equivalent? Like not a voxel. That's something different. Is there a name for that? A moxel? Pixel? Maxel? You got to come up with this. You got to coin this term, Carl. I think you got to make this thing, you know?
I mean, I don't think there is such a thing.
But in my mind, it's just like they solved that, or they had that similar problem where they were trying to drive down the cost per pixel, right? They still needed to have individualized control over RGB for each pixel. And then, you know, the schemes to do that sort of thing of like, like a crosshatch or a daisy chain or similar, you know, kind of thing where you're trying to drive all this stuff at a high refresh rate and potentially high current. I mean, LEDs benefit from silicon improvements, but it's like similar. It feels kind of similar in that way if you're trying to make like a large array of these actuators.
It is. I mean, it's like our main inspiration from it are like flip dot displays. One of the main issues with them is that they are pricey. Yeah. So that's why, I mean, hopefully we won't go through the same thing or we, but I mean, PCB coils offers, because they're pricey and they're bulky, PCB coils would at least offer the cool thing that they're Veritan. So
yeah, right. Yeah, I'm looking at your PCB actuator based on the FlexR, which is basically, it is, I mean, you have a configuration where it is basically, it's got a googly eye that is a flip dot basically, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's what we all want. We want more googly eyes and flip dots in our lives.
We're working on making something like a display, a mechanical display that's much prettier than the googly eye thingy. But
hey, I love googly eyes, so don't change it too much. Just nicer googly eyes. That's what we need, you know? All right. More googly eyes coming our way in 2024.
We'll take them.
Yeah. Kyle, where can people find you online how can they get in touch with you if they need to?
So the easiest way to find me, I think, is through YouTube or Instagram. And they can get in touch with me either via email or through the microboards.io website.
Great. Well, thank you for stopping by and telling us about all this stuff. I think it's, you know, like you're operating like on the edge of this stuff with the, you know, trying to push PCBs and flex PCBs to the edge of like what they can do. And just like,
yeah.
I really like how you show your experimentation, you share that stuff, you share like, you know, and one thing that comes through from your videos is just that you do a ton of work to get one video done and it just really shines through. So thanks for doing that, because you're helping all of us.
Yeah. That means a lot, because it really does take a lot of effort. So
yeah, hopefully it will pay off. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for stopping by, Carl. We'll talk soon.
Thank you very much for having me. Bye-bye.